Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
So welcome to today's episode of New Cyber Frontier. On with us today, we have a local legend, we'll say, William Blake is a CSSIP, and he's really involved with the local ISSA chapter. And I met him because when I spoke there a couple times, he just drilled me with more questions than anybody ever had. But one of the most knowledgeable people on cybersecurity and a lot of legacy experience. So he's going to talk about the history of cybersecurity today. So
we'll get some of that.
Some of that, huh?
Some of that.
So the history according to William Blake.
So I am a legend in my own mind.
As some of us are, right? All of us
all
are.
Of us are. Yeah. Well, we hope to be. You hope to be the hero in your own story, as they say.
Yeah, yeah. At some point, you want to at least be able to control your own path, if not be the hero, right? Be a supporting character.
Reacting to circumstances is not always a great thing.
Uh-huh. So tell us about yourself a little bit, though, William.
I claim 45 years of experience in IT and IT security.
Mm-hmm.
Started out at First National Bank of Denver when there still was a First National Bank of Denver, when they were processing, doing all the processing for all the banks up and down the Front Range from Wyoming down to Trinidad. So the stuff would come in during the day, we'd process it overnight, all their checks and everything else, and mm-hmm. do all kinds of fun stuff with it on IBM mainframes. I was a box packer, stacker, print server operator, PCAM equipment, punch card stuff.
Okay.
Did all that fun stuff. We also did, when the bank would issue checks, we printed them to include signing. We had the nice little plates with the in rubber with the stamp signature, whatever. Right, and kind of cool. You put them on a wheel, put three of them on the wheel, and you run the checks through, and each plate had every third check.
Hmm.
It was kind of interesting to do.
Do you consider that was anything in security?
It was, because we had we were responsible for physical security and around that.
Okay.
So the check numbers and whatnot, you had to be sure with all that, and then everything that went out. And it was all within a secure facility, a secure area.
So that's how they did it. I mean, the mainframe wasn't connected to.
This was 1972, 73, 74 okay. time frame. So yeah, there was no connection. There was no internets. There was no international banking system for things to be hooked into. Everything was just you want something transferred,
uh-huh.
put it on a tape, big tapes.
Wow,
the big stuff.
Tape, yeah. The paper tape.
Well, we played with paper tape, but that played with that later. We didn't do that at the bank. Yeah.
Okay.
So
I actually got to use that. On a very legacy piece of equipment.
Yeah, we did that. So after that, I was Air Force,
mm-hmm.
Computer programmer, COBOL, Fortran.
Okay.
Working Intel systems. So intelligence,
not Intel platform.
Intelligence systems. Again, IBM 360, IBM 360 95. There was only six of them. They used four to design the 370s, and the Air Force got the other two. One of them we used it was fun stuff, writing in COBOL and playing with Intel systems, and you had a sign for everything, and it was all behind locked doors, and again, more physical security than anything. But I also learned you had multiple answers for the same data.
Explain what you mean by that.
So the Intel services are collecting data.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what it is. So you collect the data, I collect the data, we get different data points. We're gonna keep them both. Now, if you ask me for a printout of the data, I'm gonna give you what you sent me. I'm not gonna give you what I have. I'm only gonna give you what you sent me.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have multiple iterations of the same data point.
It gets
really weird. The best example is the Navy. Okay, where's the ship?
Somewhere in the middle of the ocean. They have a
depends on
that
who's asking.
Long, right?
Depends on who's asking. Okay, if the Postal Service is asking where the ship is,
it's an address, an FPO.
It's an FPO. Which FPO? Okay, well, they're headed for Japan, so I'm going to send their stuff to Japan. Mm-hmm. It's where they're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if the Admiral's asking where the ship is, he needs to know it's pretty close in an area in the South Pacific. If the Captain's asking where the ship is, he better know within a couple of meters.
Mm-hmm.
So there are naval databases that have multiple different entries for where's the ship.
Yeah. So now if you think about that in terms of data today in the civilian world, how does that correspond to like my company's data?
Depends on what your company is and what it's doing. So there are instances where your company has data that, okay, who's asking?
Mm-hmm.
All right. If you're asking, if it's the government asking, what is your financial status? Well, certain government agencies are going to get a range. Okay, we are in this range,
mm-hmm.
10 million to 100 million, because that's all they need to know. They need to know what range you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Others need to know, I need to know exactly how much money you got. I need to know that you're not lying on your reports. If I'm the Securities and Exchange Commission, if I'm the IRS, I want to know what your taxes are.
So this is almost like the political aspect of data. Now, if we think about just these mass amounts of data like Google's collecting,
yeah.
Facebook is collecting, yeah. where it's just like, there's so much data that you basically have to know what you're looking for before you can even find anything.
It's all about big data, right?
People just get, here's the blob, do a search on it, and get back what you're looking for.
I'm going to make a pitch for a young man that I met here a couple years ago. Got his master's in library science from the University of Denver. I'm going, what the hell, library science? Turns out you need a librarian to do big data, to help you categorize it.
Mm-hmm.
Who'd have thought that?
So that's, if you're working on a dissertation in big data, you'd be doing a lot of librarian type.
Well, you want to be able to categorize your data. You want to be able to need a Dewey Decimal System for your data.
So now, I would refer to that, and I think I know where you're going, as the logistics.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So librarian learns logistics, because that's what I work on.
Yeah.
I work on the logistics for data using blockchain.
Okay, I can see that.
So we have some new tools to help with that with the onset of blockchain and everything. And you'll see a lot of those governance systems come up.
Blockchain is going to be way interesting. A young woman I kind of adopted in Australia, she was working for Telstra.
Mm-hmm.
And she came up with a way to use blockchain to certify the security on their IoT devices
mm-hmm.
in the homes.
Yeah. Let's take a break. I just realized I'm running time. Hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
So welcome back today. We're talking to William Blake about the history of cybersecurity. He told me it's not quite, but
we'll see.
It becomes that when you learn from somebody that has been through as many aspects and facets of cybersecurity.
So let me go on a little history of myself. So I said I went in as a computer programmer, mm-hmm. enlisted computer programmer working at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska. ended up getting my degree, mm-hmm. bachelor's in business administration, because why not? And was selected for officer training school. They said, hey, how about a commission? I said, sure, why not? Seeing as how they were sending me to Hawaii, mm-hmm. where I got to work on WMICS equipment. WMICS is the Worldwide Military Command and Control System.
Hmm.
It was all run on Honeywell processors. So now I moved from IBM to Honeywell. And it's again mainframes.
So what year progression would that have been?
That would have been 1979.
79, okay.
And we're still running mainframes. Mm-hmm. Started my master's program at that point in Hawaii on the University of Southern California. And one of the guys they brought in during the program, they brought in a guy from ARPANET.
Okay.
Which became DARPANET.
Which was the first internet.
Yes, that was the beginning of the internet. That would have been 1980,
okay.
Yeah. They brought a guy in, he set up his terminal, the little modem went off, beep, beep, boop, boop, all those, mm-hmm. you know, those us old guys know those
tones,
sounds.
Yeah.
And he showed us that he could connect with the various different colleges back on the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
And chat with people and exchange information, and it was kind of interesting. This was all pre-email. There was no email. There was no HTTP, so there were no websites.
So let's talk about what the thought was for security at that time.
There was none.
Did they ever think that somebody would use this in a way that they didn't want to? Was it just totally not in the thought process?
As it turns out, it depended on who you were. Uh-huh. Most of us said, we didn't even think about that. Most of us did not. But it had turned out that in the late 60s, the RAND Corporation, under contract to the United States Air Force, mm-hmm. did think about that. So starting in 67, 68 time frame, they put together a group of folks, a nice panel, and they wrote what you can Google on Google now and bring up the WARE report.
Mm-hmm.
It was published in 1970, and it is the How to Secure a Computer System.
1970.
That was when it was published.
And who was listening back then?
The Air Force immediately classified it, so nobody.
So yeah. Less people than now.
Yeah. So it was declassified in 1974 and published.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was in the field in the Air Force shortly after that. Never heard of it until about 8 years ago.
Hmm.
So
is it
did not get
valid?
Published.
In accordance to what we see today,
absolutely.
Has it come true?
Absolutely.
So give us some examples of that.
So one of the things, one of the big sections of it is policy.
Uh-huh.
And policy talks about physical security, personnel security. It talks about access control,
uh-huh.
both for the individuals and for the programs. It talks about how you need to design your software system, how to design your hardware systems in order to include security in them. It's all the stuff we've been telling people to do, to my knowledge, since 1998.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've been telling them since 1970. And it's the same stuff. You read through, they go, yep, yeah, I see that. If you go look at ISO 2700 series,
mm-hmm.
that used to be the British standard 7799,
mm-hmm.
you go looking through that, and you look at the sections of that, and you compare it to the WARE report, it's pretty close.
So they might have used the WARE report.
I would think so.
So in looking at it, is there anything that stands out to you that, you know, they just missed?
I think what they missed is because they missed it because they didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Then that's what I mean. What do we know now?
The decentralized computing.
Okay.
We went to this whole model of decentralized computing, and if you look, we actually kind of pulse in and out. We, mm-hmm. you know, we had, where I started at the bank, we had a fishbowl. Mm-hmm. We had all these big IBM mainframes behind glass, so they could bring executives in and say, see, all this money we're spending is right in there, and this is how we're doing it. And you mm-hmm. could bring other banks in and say, here's all of our stuff, big aquarium kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So then we went from that, and then we started putting terminals out. Okay, so now you have terminals.
That are no longer in the fishbowl.
They're not in the fishbowl. So now you got to protect the, when I was on WMICS, that was one of the things, I was a WATASO, a WMICS Terminal Area Security Officer.
And what year?
That was 81.
81, okay.
So you got this, a room with a bunch of terminals in it that are connected directly to the mainframe on a different floor. And you have pipes with the wires running through the pipes. And every day you had to walk the pipes to make sure there were no breaks in the pipes.
So security was thought about then in terms of
absolutely
physical.
Physical security.
Okay, so that's that pipe is an extension of this room. So it has the computer in it.
But we also started thinking Tempest at that time. You familiar with Tempest?
No, tell me what that is.
Okay, so Tempest is these terminals in the lines radiate in the electromagnetic spectrum.
Okay.
Okay. With the right equipment, I can pick that up.
So like a side channel monitoring attack?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
So I can see what's on your, and CRTs were notoriously dirty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, way, and printers, oh my God. You could, from literally miles away, you could point your antenna at it and you could read what's coming off the printer.
Mm-hmm.
Really cool stuff. So Tempest said, how do we stop that? We knew about it. We knew we could do that, which means somebody in the United States was doing that to our adversaries, NSA, CIA, those kind of guys. So we came up with Faraday cages. So we had some of the first smaller printers. As printers got smaller, we literally had a box that had a glass overlay so you could see into it. But there was copper mesh around the whole thing. You just literally set it over the printer. Set the printer down on top of one part of it and set the rest of it over the top of it. Enclosed it in a copper mesh to keep the electrons from coming out.
Yeah.
And so we were thinking of that stuff in the early 80s, late 70s.
But then we kind of went away from that.
Maybe really.
In the high security environments we still think about it. In the banking, they never really...
Banks never even thought about it. It was only military stuff.
Everybody military.
Talks military stuff. People talk Tempest. You get outside the military, nobody cares.
And even today, they still do that.
They still make you
keep your cell phone outside the facility. You can have it even in some of the bases around here.
Actually, I did some work for a large pharmacy company in Indianapolis, Eli Lilly. I won't name them, but when you went in, if you had a cell phone, you had to go. This was before smartphones. This was flip phones. Because they had cameras on them.
So you had to put it in a box.
Had to put it in a box and leave it. Couldn't take it in with you.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing that could record. Nothing that could take pictures.
Okay.
So Lilly was very concerned with that. All the other major pharmaceutical companies also very concerned with that.
Yeah.
They're looking at intellectual property theft.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been in the 2000s.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break again, hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Over 3 million data breaches happen every single day. That's over 2,000 records being compromised every minute. So often, we focus on securing web data access. But what if the attackers are already inside, having gained direct access to your storage through data management software? When it comes to communications that go directly into your storage devices, make SNIA your first line of protection. SNIA's conformance testing limits outdated communications that are known to be used by attackers. It works continuously behind the background to make sure your storage is protected. To find out if your data is truly secure, visit our website at www.snia.org/cybertest.
So welcome back. Talking to William Blake still about kind of the progression of cybersecurity. How's that?
That works.
Progression.
That works better.
Communication security. And the last kind of, we were at the early 80s. So kind of give us from the early 80s up through the next segment of time that you would consider.
So we started seeing more and more just distributed computing. You know, we started seeing the...
That was the big era of transferring from mainframes to distributed computing.
Yeah, we started going into a lot of mini computers.
Mm-hmm.
We started moving away from punch card as the standard to other standards for transmission mechanisms and whatnot. Some of the original stuff we worked on was you had a mini computer that would talk to the mainframe through RJE, remote job entry.
Mm-hmm.
And you had everything had to look like a punch card, 80 column punch card. That's what it had to look like. So you had to take all your data, convert it to punch card, ship it across the wires to the other end, and it looked like it was coming in from a card reader.
Hmm.
That would have been in 82, 83 time frame.
And that way you were shipping across the ARPNET at the time?
Actually, no. Dedicated lines.
Dedicated lines.
That was all dedicated
lines. So you would get a line through the phone company. and transfer transferred across. Yeah. So as we move to distributing computing, and I know we had a mass, everybody got on computers at that time, so there's a lot more. Well, did we kind of forget about security?
We broke everything. Some of the first things that brought in weren't computers, they were word processors.
Uh-huh.
So they were, today you would look at it and go, well, that's a PC. Well, it was a word processor. It was dedicated software to just do
documents. It was like an old typewriter that they just converted over to digital.
They took the functions you did on a typewriter and they put it in. And one of the better ones had white background, so it looked like paper. So the secretaries were very familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was some of the first stuff that came in. So now we're starting to be able to go back and edit data, edit your documents without having to go and retype the whole thing. So the whiteout started becoming, you know,
the less backspace arrow.
We didn't do that so much and whatnot. Kind of cool stuff. But then we started thinking, well, okay. You know, again, that was all local. There wasn't anything networked.
Mm-hmm.
Then we started bringing PCs in to replace that because now you can do more functions with that.
Mm-hmm.
Some folks were thinking security, but also what you ended up in a lot of places, you had the dedicated security guys, the automated data processing is what we called it then. The ADP guys, they would go and they go to their clients, Intel or Ops or whoever it was, and say, hey, what do you need? And they go back and they'd spend 6 months to a year trying to put it together to go on the mainframe. And the Ops guys need it now. Mm-hmm. They can't wait 6 months to a year. And we started getting these small computers come in, trash 80s and the like, small Apples, the original Apples that came out. Mm-hmm. And they would bring one of those in from home and somebody on their own would code up stuff and code what they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody thought of security. And yeah, we had a lot of issues with that kind of stuff. But because the two communities really weren't talking to each other, we didn't know how to communicate properly.
Mm-hmm.
You ended up with issues like that.
So that would have been through the late 80s into the early 90s?
Yeah, when definitely.
Everybody was getting a computer. Everybody had their own personal.
Everybody
redoing,
was a programmer.
Everybody was doing their own work.
Yeah.
There's 100 versions of every program on everybody's different computer.
Everybody's a programmer.
And then now we started connecting them up to.
And then we got network.
Yeah.
Then we got networks. Then we got Ethernet and we got Token Ring and we got all that kind of fun stuff. And it was the Wild West.
I remember whenever the first time I was in the Navy when we got a network, I think it was 95.
About
and they come in, well, I thought they were putting TV in. Like, yeah, we're getting cable across, around the ship. And then they connected up all the computers. And I remember at that time I could open up a share on the commanding officer's computer and go through his personal data files.
The biggest thing we broke at that time, when we did that, when we brought in email, we broke the secretaries.
Explain.
Okay, so before that time, if you're an executive of any sort and you have a secretary, your secretary screened everything that came into you. If they were good, I'm going to say she because 90% of them were she. If she was good, you only saw what you needed to see. You didn't see any spam.
Gotcha.
You didn't see any of that crap.
And they checked you before it went out, too.
Absolutely.
I need that. I hit that send button sometimes like,
oh. I had that. Oh, it was amazing. I had good, I had bad, but I had secretaries that I lived by. They were my savior so many times. Incredible. You want to go see the boss? Go through the secretary. You want to call the boss? You call the secretary first. You send an email to an office. You didn't send it to an individual. You sent a mail letter, wrote it up, put it in an envelope, or inner office, whatever, the little holy, the big holy sheets, so you could see which, where it was going. You routed it that way. The secretary opened it first. If only it was important, did the boss see it?
Mm-hmm.
Now we got email. Now the bosses are running their own email. Mm-hmm. Oh, we broke that whole system, didn't we?
Yeah,
we broke it bad. This was a system that developed over hundreds of years, and we broke it overnight. And when I say we, I mean we. All of us folks in automatic data processing, information technology, computer security, computer science.
I remember watching the Microsoft antitrust case really close.
Oh, yeah, that was
and
cool.
And all the email that they pulled from the executives to just totally corner that you know, them in that case. Like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't say that. Well, your email says
your
right
email
here.
Of this day, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So now we broke the secretaries. Now what's the attack vector everybody uses when they social engineer?
Direct access phishing.
Secretaries. I call the secretary. Hey, the boss sent me an email that said he needs some stuff refit. You have his password, don't you? I know you do. Can you give me his password?
Yeah.
And they give it. So we really broke the system, and then we didn't provide training to the secretaries on how to.
Or we use such a commoditized pool of them, yeah. No longer have that in the know, yeah. About the organization.
Well, let's talk about the organization, especially in the military. People move around all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I need to talk to the deputy director of communications for Pacific Air Forces.
Okay. Send him an email. If he reads it.
Who do I send the email to?
Go in the directory, right?
I got to figure out who the guy is.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't I just send it to the office? I could just send mail to the office. And if the guy had just changed out yesterday, the new guy's going to get the mail.
So I see that. So it's kind of like a individualized cultural change that now you have to know that right person.
Yeah. We changed organization structures to cult of personality, which is not a good thing. So, yeah, when I say we broke stuff, I mean we really broke stuff. And we're still trying to figure out how to make it right. So that's, yeah, so I did that kind of fun stuff until the late 90s.
So this is, I mean, this is a social thing we're not talking about. We're not talking about security, like on the wire, cryptology, or
it's all about the people.
It's about the people.
Yeah.
So if we look at it in terms of that, and we hear even today that the social engineering, the people problem is the biggest one, how can we get that back? Or is it just totally gone?
That's a really good question. I wish I had the answer. I really do. I don't know. I've been thinking through that for a long time. You look at the guys that are doing phishing training.
Mm-hmm.
There was phishme.com. I don't know if those guys are still around or not. They came to a couple of our conferences here in town and talked to us. A really nice presentation. I just read one this morning from one of the other ones they did. So they go into an organization and they send out a phishing email.
Mm-hmm.
And they, if you click on the phishing email, it takes you to a web page that says, this is a phishing email, don't do this anymore. And they slowly increase, you know, the quality. You go from having a lot of misspelled words and stupid things to getting really high quality, so it really looks like a real email from a real person. And they provide all this training, and after years worth of training, they find that about 5 to 10% of the people will always click on the link. Always. They asked the guy, they sent one out that said, this is a phishing email. If you click on this link, bad things will happen. And a guy clicked on the link. They asked him, why did you click on the link? He said, I wanted to see what would happen. Well, you get fired. That's what happens.
You know what? It's kind of changed a little bit. I've explained this a couple times, but I did some web link send outs for cybersecurity and didn't get much impact. And an SEO company did an analysis on it and said people aren't clicking on cybersecurity links.
Oh.
And they would send it out like with a placebo, with other topics.
Right, right.
They get more hits on the placebo.
Uh-huh.
And why is because there's been so much of this happening now that the top two reasons people gave were, one, if I see a cybersecurity link, I think somebody's trying to hack me.
Yeah.
And two, if I see a cybersecurity link, I'm reminded I'm not supposed to click on things I don't know.
So you have to hide your stuff.
So basically now we can't train people on cybersecurity because they consciously avoid the topic.
That's insane. I love that.
So all these anti-phishing people have trained them well.
You don't click
on anything that seems like a cybersecurity link. So now we're not going to learn anything about cybersecurity.
But if it's a Facebook post from my second cousin's third...
You know, kittens dancing,
yeah.
You're in there, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So we're up through what year? We're talking about late 90s, right?
We're late 90s now. So late 90s, I left the Air Force, and was a lying, cheating, thieving, slicker, godless, blood-sucking, overpaid contractor for about a year and a half.
All right.
Defense contractor. I did that for about a year and a half. Helped set up the Information Protection Office in Air Force Space Command under contract. Mark Spencer was the competing contractor. That's how I know Mark. We've known
I know
each
Mark.
Other.
He's one of the professors
he's a legend.
Where I work,
yeah,
too.
He is a legend. So, yeah, I taught him well, quite literally. So we did a lot of fun stuff. We had,
That's Mark Henrik I was talking about.
Oh, no, Mark Spencer's. Yeah.
I think I heard him talk about one time he spoke on medical security, right?
Yeah. No, Mark would not have talked medical security. Mark is, he's one of our president emeritus. Emeritus, that's one. For ISSA, he was the president for a lot of years here. He did teach a couple of classes at CTU. He does have his doctorate. I don't know what his doctorate's in. B-52 pilot, ex-buff pilot. Yeah, but he and I go way back. So, we did fun stuff. Did you ever read The Cuckoo's Egg?
I haven't.
Read that one. That's one of the first novels.
You think is it cyber security related?
Yes, it's the first. It's the first novel. It's the first nonfiction
sci-fi
work.
Story.
No, it's nonfiction.
Huh.
And it's the story of one of the first cyber attacks.
So what would in your career? Let's go back to the first cyber attack you remember.
The I Love You virus.
What year is that? Early 2000s?
No, that was 99 time frame.
Was that the, I'm trying to think of what that one was. Was that the one where it was like a the time bomb or whatever that was on a certain time and somebody wrote it to his girlfriend or something and couldn't get it on her computer, so he made it transfer itself and
that's the first one I saw.
Self-propagating.
Yeah, the first one, the very first one that's documented is the Morris worm.
Did you see that one?
I never saw that one. That one.
I Love You. Was that damaging or was it just?
It was
annoying.
No, it was damaging. That one actually deleted files.
So it was doing a hard drive format type of thing.
Yeah.
A lot of love there.
A lot of love there. That code was pretty good.
Yeah, the first time I remember hearing about them was around the early 2000s. But the first time I got involved with what I would call cybersecurity was 1998 or 99, somewhere around there. But it was industrial controls.
Yeah.
And somebody was putting a file to execute a laser that cut steel across the network. They could put the file in the machine and start it without an operator being there. So they had bypassed the safety function of an operator,
making sure
everything was set up and holding certain.
So it could start blazing steel when the steel wasn't there.
And what happened is there was a fire.
Oh, I would imagine.
had got away with it for quite a while, and the engineer was pretty thrifty about it. He had found a way not to have an operator there in the morning and make money.
Yeah.
And miss the startup time for it and everything.
So just make sure materials were in place.
So he was saving money for the company for months until he, burnt down the whole place.
Oops. All that savings, always comes back. It's always that way. It's easier to put stuff on after the fact.
Uh-huh. But, at that time, and it's literally up until when I told you I got involved with the SGIP, and the NERC SIP was about disconnecting. Air gapping everything. At that time, that's what we did. We just air gapped it, made it so that it couldn't connect to the network.
Still the best. I mean, that's still your best. It's not perfect. Stuxnet showed the air gap doesn't always work.
Yes, that's true. So, for people listening, Stuxnet was a virus that started with a USB drive.
Yes.
So we won't go too into depth on that. Let's go into progression here. We're early 2000s, right?
So early 2000s, I got called by IBM and said, "How would you like to be a IT security consultant?" And I went, "Yeah." So I went off and did that. I was a...
Was that mainframes or was that distributed computing?
Yes, all of the above.
Okay.
It was, we primarily looked at distributed computing kind of platforms because that's the majority of stuff that is in use in Fortune 500 companies around the world.
Mm-hmm. So up until that time, I'm kind of stepping back a little bit, late 90s, I was working on networking. So yeah,
okay,
we're going a little bit over. We'll right. a couple minutes yeah, here. Yeah. And I remember there was Novell, there was Apple had their own networking yep. protocol.
IBM had their own,
IBM had their own. Token Microsoft ring. Had their own. Anyway, now we've kind of narrowed it down. But all those computer networking things were wide open. We didn't think about security.
Not really. To some degree.
What was the thought back then at that time?
To some degree, you still had access control. Okay, when we started putting this stuff in, you did have access control. In order to pull in your email, you had to have a password.
But if you were listening to the network,
if you listened to the network, everything was unencrypted if you could touch the network.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, to be honest, a lot of it was, we thought, I was a communications guy at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that if you put enough stuff on a line, if you mux together multiple lines onto the big line that the telco is going to transmit,
mm-hmm.
that you couldn't pull the individual ones out.
And that's what made
them secure. Turns out we were mistaken.
I think that's a whole new topic on the whole assumption of a security by obscurity. Make it hard to get out, and it's safe.
Yeah, but we learned that was not true.
Yeah,
but so let's go back into communications. Let's talk basic communications theory.
Well, you know what I was thinking here before we go that route.
Okay,
we're about the time we usually do for a show. I think we're going to break here and bring you back on.
All right,
and do a part two to this one.
We can do that,
and that way people have something to look forward to. So we're going to say goodbye for today, and bring you back on. And for you people listening, we're just going to keep recording, but you're going to get it next week. So thanks again, and come back next week for the follow on to this conversation. The views or opinions expressed during this podcast are not those of Colorado Technical University.
You have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.